talking about Farrington. There's an international organization in solar energy. Started out as the Association for Applied Solar Energy, and then got to be the Solar Energy Society, and is now the International Solar Energy Society. Well, you can imagine that during these dry years, when there was little interest, that this organization was on very shaky grounds indeed. And Farrington, more than any other person, by all odds, was responsible for the continued existence of this Solar Energy Society. He was the president of it for a couple of years, and he personally backed it financially out of his own pocket. The organization was in debt, and Farrington paid the interest on the indebtedness. I don't know how much of his personal funds he invested over the years, but he paid the interest on a $10,000 note for some years. And I think the fact that that organization still exists and today is a thriving, growing organization just wouldn't have happened if he hadn't made it happen.
That's something I didn't know.
Well, he never talked about that sort of thing, but he just thought it was something that ought to be done, and he did it. Well, before he died, when he was quite ill, I used to go over him once in a while and talk to him. And I think he was always glad that there was interest in the solar energy field. But I also had the feeling that he was politely interested in the work we were doing, which is aimed at applications in the U.S. and fundamentally interested in other kinds of applications. I think he probably didn't really understand the kinds of things that we were trying to do, although I think they're all, what he was doing and what we were doing have the same long-term objective. His book is Direct Use of the Sun's Energy continues to be a real popular book. People refer to it all the time. So he really made his mark. He not only got the College of Engineering interested in starting a program, which is the one that's going now, but he came over and did some experimental work here. And he kept this society alive, and he was really, well, in the late 60s and early 70s, he was telling people that they ought to be interested in solar energy, and I'm sure that his words, when he was vice president of the National Academy of Sciences and so on, that people remembered what he said, and when the fuel crisis hit, his words were remembered. Well, it might be worth talking a little bit about the current program, because I don't mind doing a little bragging. It's something I'm very proud of, and I think it ought to go on the record.
Good.
We have a program here today that I think is, in many respects, one of the finest in the country. And it's due to two things. First of all, it's Bill Beckman, who in recent years has become just a phenomenal colleague. He's absolutely tops. He's first class and working with students. He's just a tower of strength. He's the main reason that things are going as well as they are. A secondary reason is that we have been extremely fortunate in having first-class students. And students really make this place hum. I mean, Bill and I can do some things, but what you really need is a bunch of young guys around who are spending a lot of time and working on various aspects and reading and studying and doing things in depth that 10 smart people can do in a way that one or two smart people can't do. Our students are in demand. Their stuff gets published and sought after. And they're just... This laboratory, in my view, is what a university laboratory ought to be. It's a place where a couple of faculty people can put some challenging questions to first-class students and guide their work and have them come out with knowledge and ideas and work that is of interest to the engineering community at large, publishable, if you like to put it that way, where those students are in demand as employees in all kinds of organizations.
I'm assuming that you don't have the job placement problem that some areas do.
The telephone rings with people wanting to know, do you have anybody coming out who are interested in hiring people? I could place a number of people today if we had the people, but we don't. So jobs are no problem for these people. Well, we've had a lot of success. We've devised Transys, this solar simulation program that is probably the major simulation program in this country, and about 10 copies of it have been sent abroad. We've had some outstanding visitors from abroad here. We've had two Australians here. Dr. Peter Cooper was a postdoc or project associate with us for 6 months a couple of years ago. He helped in the early stages of Transys. He and Sandy Klein used to sit by the hour and argue about things. Well, they were honing their ideas, and he was a real contributor. More recently, Don Close, from Australia, spent 6 months with us. And with Don, we're getting into another kind of a program, or working on other kinds of problems, what we call open cycle cooling problems. Today we know pretty much how to design good heating systems and hot water systems. But there's a lot of problems remaining in solar air conditioning. We know ways to do it, but we also know that there's a lot of possible ways that haven't yet been explored. We can sort of say, all right, here's the standard ways that you do a heating system, but if you want to do cooling, we just aren't at that point yet. And we may change our ideas on heating, too. Well, Don, in cooperation with some other people in Australia for some years, has been working on these open cycle cooling systems. And he's a very intelligent fellow who was just a great asset to us. I'm using an awful lot of superlatives, but that's how I feel about these things.
Well, that's fine in that case.
I really think that we hold a very strong position in the national scheme of things, even in the international scheme of things. We're 3 or 4 jumps ahead of the competition most of the way.
That's always nice.
And there is competition.
Yes, I gather today, certainly.
Well, Don was with us for 6 months. Incidentally, my son Neil, who has a master's degree from the university, has gone off and worked for Don Close for a year. We knew Don from many years ago from a number of associations. And while I'm on the subject of Australia, I'm going back to Australia for 6 months in November of this year. And Bill Beckman hopes to go back for 6 months in a year from this
winter. When you return, yeah.
So we have a steady stream of people back and forth. And as a matter of fact, we're now trying to plan a joint research program between ourselves and Australia. Well, the last thing we said to Don was, when he left, is we better find some commuting money. Well, that's a long commute.
It's a long commute, right.
But they're very good people, and we've I think we've got a lot to gain by association with them. Well, the next step after Transys was to develop some more usable design procedures. And have done this. Sandy Klein has done this as a part of his PhD thesis. About a year ago, we presented a paper, which should be published any day now, on a design method. And this design method is already, it's the first one that was out, and it's a versatile one, and it's already being widely used just from the preprints that we sent out. So, I mean, here's Sandy's thesis was just put in the library a few days ago, but parts of that are standard operating procedure and being used by research people and designers and so on. This is one of the reasons we feel good about the present program.
I'm
very, very proud of what our students have been able to accomplish. Well, I don't know exactly where we're going to go from here. We've had our original program with NSF was renewed. We're now under IRTA. We're coming to the end of the second period under IRTA. All of this in this phase two, the second sort of phase of this solar program at Wisconsin. Our plans for the future are to work along somewhat the same lines. There's lots more to do in simulation and development of design procedures. There's just a host of challenging problems ahead. But we want to get a little bit more into experimental work, and we are now starting to build up at Arlington an experimental house. The house will have a new collector system, which has been analyzed by one of our students, and a novel heating system, which has been designed by another one of our students. And that's going to be a very interesting experiment. It's supported in part by IRTA, in part by the state, by the Wisconsin Electric Utilities Research Foundation, because these things have implications to the utilities. And we also are getting materials contributed from Johnson Controls over in Milwaukee and Heard Millwork in Medford, Wisconsin are giving us the windows and so on for the house. So we're getting bits and pieces from here and there. All very valuable support.
Is somebody actually going to live there when you get
it finished? This is going to provide an experiment for us in a residence, a needed residence on the Arlington Farms. The school needed another building up there for a residence and thought, well, look, let's do something just beyond just another building. Let's make it an experiment. And we hope that this winter we'll begin to get experimental data on how it operates, and after we get it shaken down and make sure it's operating so nobody's going to freeze in there, we'll turn it over to the Ag School and they'll have one of their farm families living in it.
When do you expect it to be finished?
Well, we'd expected it to be finished last fall, but I think it'll be finished this fall. It's a hole in the ground now. Well, there may be a foundation up there now. It's kind of an interesting problem. One of the problems that the utilities face, for example, the utilities are very critically interested in solar heating and cooling. They see opportunities and problems in this. The problem being primarily the fact that if very many solar heated buildings used electric auxiliary, electric standby to carry loads when solar can't, they could be subjected to very severe peak loads in the wintertime that could be as bad or worse than the peak air conditioning loads that they experience in the summertime.
Oh, really?
And, well, there are two obvious answers to this problem. One is to use an auxiliary energy that's stored on site, like bottled gas or oil. Those are probably the most logical candidates. But the other is to use off-peak electric and store energy at the building.
You store electrical energy?
Well, what we plan to do at the Arlington House is to store thermal energy. We'll convert electrical to thermal and store heat. And we have a storage unit in the solar heating system anyway. So the problem then from an engineering point of view is how do you combine these storage systems? Well, this is what Pat Hughes, a student, has worked out. And he'll present a paper on this at a meeting up in Winnipeg this summer. I'm sure it'll be published because it's bound to be a paper of wide interest. And, we'll have some experimental information, hopefully next year. Well, the other, that's going to carry us for a while. Another aspect of the program for the future is going to be this open cycle cooling business with the Australians. I don't know just what else we'll do from there, but the problem is to pick out the things that we want to do out of the host of challenges and opportunities that there are. If we can continue to get the kind of students that we've had in the past, we have additional staff interest in the program now. John Mitchell in mechanical engineering is becoming a very substantial contributor on some aspects of the program, working with a couple of our students on combined solar energy heat pump systems and on Rankine engine, solar energy Rankine engine systems. Saeed Abdel Khalik, who spent some time with us as a postdoc, has been away and now he's back as an assistant professor in nuclear engineering. He got his PhD in mechanical engineering with a minor in chemical, and has had a couple of postdoc positions and worked in industry for a while. But he's a superb applied mathematician, and he's working with one of our students on a problem that's mathematical in nature, on chemical energy storage. So with that kind of support, there really are four faculty people now who are involved, primarily Bill Beckman and myself, and secondarily John Mitchell and Saeed Abdel Khalik. They're all really good people, and if we can continue to get good students, the place is going to keep on humming.
Well, shortage of the predicted shortage of energy sources, certainly in the price of fuel oil, has made everybody conscious of possibilities in other areas in a way that they
I think
weren't.
As I see it, the chances of any reduction from the current costs of energy are zero. It just is not going to happen for a couple of reasons. First of all, there is no reason to think that the people who are exporting oil are going to ever settle for anything less than they're now getting. They know they can get it. All they have to do is to hang together, and the oil importing countries have no choice but to pay the price. The price, as one member of a congressional staff I heard talking about this a few days ago said, the price bears no relation to the cost. He said, look, it costs a quarter to pump a barrel of oil out of the ground in the Middle East, and they sell it for $12 or $14. But they are not going to give away their resources. I think that it's imprudent for this country to continue to import huge quantities of petroleum for years into the future. The exporters of that oil come over here and buy General Motors and the shoe goes on the other foot, there will be a hue and cry that will bring this to the public's attention in a forceful way or another embargo. I think it's just not in the cards to continue to pour major national resources into these other countries whose interests are not coincident with ours. Then there's a third factor in the long run. our 5% of the population is still using, what, a third or something like that of the world's energy. And the bulk of the world's population are still essentially negligible users of energy. And communications improve every day, and I think that the odds of the people in the developing countries being willing to settle for so small a piece of the action as they have now are that just isn't going to happen. As I see, in years ahead, perhaps some years ahead, an increasing demand for energy from the 90% of the population that uses very little now, and it just isn't going to take much demand at all on a per capita basis. There's so many of those people. The population of non-energy users is so large that any increase in their standard of living is going to consume massive amounts of energy resources. And I just can't see that these energy resources are ever going to be cheap again. I think we've moved out of the cheap energy era and are into an expensive energy era, and I think the costs are going to go up. Solar energy is marginally economic now in a lot of places. I think the situation is going to improve as time goes on. Look, it's going to have some ups and downs depending on the whims of the moment. But every time the Shah sneezes, the solar energy program gets a boost. I think we're in for expensive energy. And this country is going to have to look to alternatives. Solar is one of those alternatives. I think it's going to go this time. I don't think we're going to have another dry spell like we did. I may be wrong, but I don't think so.
Well, given the world situation right now, I think I would have to agree with you. People are talking about energy in a way I don't recall ever having heard before. And I think a lot of people are somewhat surprised when they're told that there is the capability, that there are equipment on the market that today even, if they're really interested in building a home and installing solar heating. I don't think most of us have realized that.
Well, look at the situation in Madison. There's one solar heated house in this community built by George Button out on Lake Mendota Drive. And he bought this system from a new company. The company's been in existence for a couple of years, an outfit called Solaron. Incidentally, George Lurf, the man I spoke of earlier, is the technical brains behind Solaron. The system he put on there was very expensive. The people who put it on for him had never seen one of these things before. People have to learn. The next one they put on, they'll know a lot more about, and they'll probably do a much better job of putting it in and spend a lot less time and effort on it. I'm sure that the heating contract, matter of fact, I talked to him, I know he invested in that. But it's like having the first automobile in town. Nobody quite knows what to do with these strange beasts the first time around. After there's a few of them around, it's quite different. It's true that you can buy solar heating systems now, and you couldn't a couple of years ago. It's also true today that these things do tend to be expensive. We say roughly, look, 10 or 15% of the cost of a house will put an optimized solar heating system on. That's pretty steep, and there's all kinds of problems involved in this. Presumably people are going to have to add the cost of these systems to the mortgage. Well, that means that the lending institutions are going to have to be willing to boost the amount of money that they lend on a house. Well, we know of half a dozen banks around the country that are getting themselves educated on what constitutes a good or a poor solar heating system, and are preparing to, or are prepared now, to make loans on them. Matter of fact, there's a half a dozen banks that have solar heating systems on their own buildings. There's a bank out in Longmont, Colorado, a savings and loan association, for example, that built a new branch and put a solar heating system on it. They get lots of publicity and they get some experience. They know how those things work. And I think that the lending institutions are gradually coming around to the point where they're willing to help make these sorts of things possible. There's a whole set of other legal, social aspects, not only the availability of capital, but the fact that you have to educate people to know how to design systems, you gotta have to educate people to know how to install them. Aside from all the research and development, the sorts of things that we do in the university. But there are, all these things are coming. There's another major question of tax incentives. Should solar energy, solar heating and cooling systems be encouraged somehow by the federal government? You put a solar heating system on your house today and the local tax collector will come out and boost your assessment and you get to pay extra taxes on it. Well, is that reasonable or isn't it? If you decide that it's in the national interest to not import so much oil, maybe you don't want to do that, or maybe you want to subsidize the thing on a national level and go ahead and pay those taxes on a state level. They're not easy questions to answer, but in many respects, the future of solar energy is going to depend on political situation and not on engineering. I think we can handle the engineering problems. The politics is going to determine where and when.
Do you see a reduction in the future in the initial cost of installing a solar heating system?
I think costs will go down some. I suspect that if you actually went out in Madison today to put a solar heating system on, that you probably would pay not the 10 or 15%, but 20% of the cost. These things are still pretty expensive. They are being made now in numbers that are, the equipment is being made in volume large enough so that some of the advantages of mass production are being realized, but it's still a pretty small business. Solaron, this company out in Denver, figures they're going to do $1 million a year worth of business this year. Well, that's pretty good, but it's still pretty small in the total scheme of things. The labor content in the equipment itself is not very high, but the labor content in installing the equipment is quite high. And I think it's primarily labor saving is where their cost reduction has to be. And I don't see that the price of steel and glass is going to change an awful lot. That will go up, not down. So I think there's some room for cost reduction. There's still lots of room for innovation and system design. We still don't know everything we need to know about that, so systems may evolve that will work better. Maybe you need less of this expensive equipment. So I think things will come down a little bit. I don't think they're going to go down to a quarter of what they are now, but they might go down to three quarters, or maybe as far as a half.
So you'd still have a large initial outlay to balance against reduced operating costs.
That's right. That's the nature of the beast. You invest money and pay it off to the mortgage company, but you reduce your fuel bill. So the balance then in the cash flow sense is a reduction in what you pay to the oil man and an increase in what you pay to the bank. And it's that sort of a balance that the banker and the homeowner are probably going to look at in deciding whether or not to go. In this sense, it's sort of a gamble of whether you put solar heating on or not. It's a gamble in the sense that you're speculating on what fuel prices are going to be in the future. I mean, your decision on whether to go or not go on solar is based not on today's fuel price, but on what you think fuel prices are going to be, say, averaged over the next 20 years.
Well, and there's a suggestion, too, that the world's, at least oil supplies, are not limitless.
Yeah, So the price of oil goes up and the comparison looks better and better for solar. Because you make an investment today in solar and that's fixed, and then your other costs tend to increase.
What kind of life expectancy does a solar system have?
Well, a well-designed and well-built solar heating system ought to last, basically it ought to last as long as the house. There are some that aren't very well built, and they're giving trouble. But it'll last 20 years, the period of the mortgage, 30 years. I think if it doesn't, it's not a well-designed system. So you have a balance of extra investment on the one hand against increasing the lifetime on the other. I don't know just where these things are going to settle down, but I think they're going to be long-lived, low-maintenance systems, and they can be. I don't think there's any question about that.
How does the scope of this program here compare with others around the country?
Well, there really isn't anybody else who is working along the same lines that we are in quite the same way. Now, there are some comparable or, in a sense, competitive programs. We have been concentrating on simulation methods and design methods. Another organization that's done some of the same kinds of things that we have is Los Alamos Scientific Laboratories. And there's a very good group out there. They have chosen, for one reason or another, to not develop generalized simulation programs like TRANSIS. They have gone part way in developing design procedures, but their design procedures aren't quite as general as ours, although their approach is quite similar. Another organization that has done a lot of the same kinds of things that we have is Arthur D. Little. Now, theirs is done on a proprietary basis. They solicited a whole bunch of industries and collected, I think, $15,000 from each one, put this together in a big kitty and ran a research program, which the results of which are available to the members of that industrial consortium. We have never seen their simulation programs, but we know something about them. We've seen reports on them. But their stuff isn't generally available, and if you happen to be a member of that club, okay, it's available to you. But
they don't publish it.
They don't publish it. So in that sense, it's not a part of the same body of literature that we contribute to. There are other university programs, most of them quite different than our own. UCLA, for example, still has a very good program. A part of that is a little part of that is on simulations, but most of it is more fundamental studies on heat transfer problems and collectors. University of Waterloo in Canada, the same thing. There's a number of universities that have programs that are primarily experimental in nature. The most notable one, I suppose, is Colorado State University. We work closely with them. George Lerf is the director out there. We've been colleagues on many ventures of one sort or another, although we have no formal arrangements with him at the moment. So I think ours is a rather special kind of a program that really has no direct counterpart in any other universities.
Was this program one of the early ones?
Well, going back a little bit in history, the solar energy program has kind of an interesting history in the sense that it's had its ups and downs. It's had these highs and lows before the ones that we've been mixed up with. The first use of solar was the one that really substantial use, in a way, was a program, well, a solar still that was built in Chile in 1872 and ran for some 25 or 30 years supplying drinking water to animals used in nitrate mines. Well, this was in a kind of an industrial application, and there's been lots of solar still work done since, all based on the same basic ideas. Then there was a flurry of interest along about 1900 in solar power systems, power in the sense of converting solar energy to thermal energy to run a steam engine or something like that. And then the next real stimulus to the solar energy field was a gift by Godfrey L. Cabot to MIT and Harvard. This really got the MIT solar energy program going. This was in 1938. And if there's one classic paper in this field, it's a paper by Hottel and Wirtz that appeared in the 1942 Transactions of ASME, detailing how flat plate collectors work. And this was is a remarkable paper that anticipated so many things that we worry about today. We have to go back and reread it every once in a while and see just how good a job those people did, because an awful lot of the answers were published 34 years ago.
Well, I know MIT built this. I guess we discussed the other day, built this this house with
it. Yeah, they built a series of houses. So they had a combined analytical and experimental program that has really been a substantial source of information on which we do a lot of our work. So that was that late 30s, early 40s work was really a high point. Then George Lerf got into the field in the early 40s, I mentioned before, because of the war. The MIT people were working along. There was a student by the name of Austin Hillier at another student of Hottel's, who finished in 55, who wrote a very fine thesis on flat plate collectors, and we use their design methods and analytical methods to a very great extent. There were other programs. There was a PhD thesis written up at Minnesota by Ben Liu that has turned out over the years to be a very useful source of information on how to treat radiation data. There's an economic study that, well, we were very peripherally involved in it at Ohio State that was supported by Resources for the Future, done by Dick Tybaut and George Lerf. Well, Tybaut is an economist on the faculty at Ohio State. George was a kind of an advisor to him. An early simulation study in which they looked at the economics of solar heating systems using some relatively crude simulations. And also later on did some similar studies of the economics of solar cooling. Well, one of the first things that as a part of that program was a study of the availability of solar radiation data. Well, we did that study. Clayton Smith did it, actually. And we published it back in, I guess, about 1966, and that's a fairly extensive report that the Engineering Experiment Station sells. And it's been a bestseller for the last 5 years. They keep reprinting it and selling it because there's all kinds of people who want to get a hold of those kinds of data. And Clayton did a very extensive job of compiling and making sense out of a lot of data from a lot of miscellaneous sources. Well, there were other. There's a program down at Florida that was very much experimentally oriented, few others here and there, but I would say that the work that we use as the basis for our own comes out of MIT, from that Cabot Fund, the work of Hottel and his students. There was Ben Liu's work Lou and Jordan up at Minnesota. There is George Lerf's work, some of which was associated with universities, some on his own. There's Australian work, which was very fine. There's some work done in Israel, which was very fine.
Oh, really?
That's not all of it, but that's a good share of it. But for years, the field was so small that everybody knew everybody. And it was interesting to get together at meetings because at a good meeting, all 25 people in the field would be there, and everybody knew everybody, and everybody knew what everybody was doing.
I take it from what from your remarks, this is becoming less the case.
Well, the Solar Energy Society American section, which includes Canada, U.S., and some membership in Mexico, is I would guess is well over the 3,000 mark now.
A little hard to know that many.
Yeah.
You referred to the Engineering Experiment Station a minute ago. Is this program a part of that?
Well, we have students here from both chemical and mechanical engineering. I'm on the member of the chemical engineering department, and Bill is a member of the mechanical engineering department. It's sort of hung between the two departments. We draw students from both of them. We teach a course that's joint listed. We draw students about half and half from both of the departments. And it just turns out to be a lot easier to run the thing administratively through the experiment station rather than through one of the departments. It's just a matter of convenience.
I see. It doesn't really affect what you do.
No. We get all kinds of help from anybody that we ask for it these days. We need a little help from the chemical engineers or the mechanical engineers or the experiment station. They're all very good about helping us make things go.
What, if any, relations do you have you had with the College of Life and Sciences, say the chemistry department or the physics department?
Well, not very much in the current program. The early program had people on the advisory committee from LNS, Farrington, and Werner Sumi, and Bill Sarles, Jerry Rolick from civil engineering. There's somebody else on that committee. Jerry Gerloff from Botany, I think, was on it for a while. But in recent years, there really hasn't been very much direct interchange from physics and chemistry. The program has really been very substantially engineering oriented. It's an engineering research program. It's really not physics. It's really not chemistry. It's engineering. And there are physics and chemistry problems involved, but the people here are not working on those problems, or at least they haven't been. And our work has really not depended on those departments here.
I see.
Well, we know lots of people over there and talk to them a lot, but as far as any direct participation is concerned, there just hasn't been any.
Well, I was curious about that. Now, I also know you've been active in the graduate school. In what capacity?
Well, for some years I was director of the University Industry Research Program, and at that time that job carried with it an associate deanship in the graduate school. My predecessor in that program was Jerry Rolick. He was the first director of UIR, and he chose not to be very active in the graduate school, but I found it to be advantageous to be a little more active in there, so I did spend some time on grad school matters, particularly on the support of research.
Now, were you on the research committee?
Yes, I was on the research committee. Actually, I had been on the research committee starting, I think, back in about 1958 when John Willard was dean, and stayed on until I went to Australia, and then I got off then. And then, well, after I got back from Australia, when I was asked if I would take over UIR, part of that was to go back on the research committee. So I've spent about as many years on the committee as anybody up there, I guess. been on it ever since. Well, I stayed in UIR, helped build that program for, I think it was 6 years. The record would have to be looked up to see if my memory is any good on that. Then I found the work in the grad school to be very interesting, and I, when we were cranking up the modern phase of the program again, I moved into the graduate school as a half-time associate dean. In other words, I was no longer working on UIR problems, but got concerned with the usual grad school kinds of things, of students and program development and academic records and admissions and research and all of the usual sorts of activities up there. And I have been in that position for the last 3 years, but I'm going to be stepping out of that in November when I go back to Australia. It's an activity that I've enjoyed. The contacts up there have been very stimulating. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. But I think it's time somebody else took on that chore for a while.
Have you, I assume it, you must have found it somewhat time-consuming.
Yes, there's always a problem. I've had a half-time appointment in the grad school and a half-time in engineering for a long time now. Well, occasionally it's actually when UIR matters were really pressing, I think I was up to three-quarter time grad and one-quarter engineering for quite a while. But it's very difficult to make a split that corresponds to the split in the payroll. Things are boiling over here, you're here working on things, and when things get real busy up there, you're up there working hard on things. Well, the program here has been accelerating for a long time now, for the past 4 years, and I want to be in a position to give more attention to it when I get back from Australia. So, for that reason, plus the fact that I think it's time somebody else, I think a job like that, being an associate dean up there, is stimulating and exhilarating and depressing and all the things that go with a job like that. It's been a great experience and I wouldn't have missed it for anything. But I think it's time somebody else did it. Time I should go back to being a professor on a full-time basis.
What, you mentioned Wharf a little while ago. What are your opinions about Wharf?
I think Wharf has been an absolutely tremendous asset to this university. In my own personal experience and in the value that I have seen of it to others. As a matter of fact, I think our situation here is kind of a classical example of how Wharf can really help the research programs of the university without spending an awful lot of money on it. Several things. First of all, we had a little Wharf money early in the first phase of the program to help get the thing started. Not much, but a little bit, and that was a real help. In 1964, when I went to Australia, Wharf money topped off what I was able to get from Guggenheim and Fulbright, and made it possible for me to go. I had three kids to go along. You know, it's not cheap to even, wasn't even cheap then to go. But Wharf made it possible, and I think the things that we did then were necessary precursors to the sorts of thing that we're doing now. So I think the few thousand dollars of Wharf money that were invested in that trip have been repaid many times. Bill Beckman also went. He spent a year at CSIRO in Melbourne. And he had Wharf support to top off his, and I think that the things that he did there have been a real asset to him and to our program, our present program. So I think that was a fine investment. Back in, I guess it was either 70 or 71, when we first wrote our proposal to NSF RAN for the starting up the current phase of the program, we were able to plunge right in and start the thing going, because we knew that if there were delays in getting the funding from NSF, that we could go to WARF for support. We actually never asked them, but just the knowledge that they were there and would back us. Maybe we did get support for one of the students. No, I don't think we did. I don't think we actually... We may have had very modest support, but just the fact that WARF was there made it possible for us to charge ahead and move with certainty, make commitments to people, and enable us to get the jump on some of our competition. It really helped us a lot. When our original WARF contract or NSF contract ran out and our current one began, we were caught in a changeover of the solar program from NSF to IRDA. Our current grant was actually approved by the NSF board in December, and in the beginning of January, all of the solar stuff was moved out of NSF and into IRDA. Well, it took them 6 months to get around to writing a contract.
Oh my goodness.
And when they finally did, they backdated it, and the university just let us go ahead and spend. We just kept right on going. We made commitments to people, and we knew again that if there was a glitch in Washington, that WARF was there to back us up. And we would have, if we had had to cut back waiting for the administrative mess to get straightened out, we would not be in the position that we are today. We're in a very strong position. I'm working now on a draft of another renewal, in effect a third IRDA contract. And I think we can make very persuasive arguments and come up with another third of $1 million without too much trouble.
Okay.
And WARF is there to back us, and the amount of money that we spend out of there is essentially zero. But just having it there is just makes all the difference in the world. Right now, we're making commitments to students for next year. We don't have the money. We'll get it, and we don't hesitate to do it because we know we're going to get backing. We're sufficiently sure of ourselves as far as IRDA is concerned that we don't even proposition WARF, although Bob Bach, the dean of the grad school and the chairman of the research committee, knows, just because I see him so much, what our situation is. It's been a real asset to us.
I'm sort of assuming that because you do have outside funding, and is that the budget crisis that the university as a whole is facing has not tied your hands too much.
No, we have not been hurt, at least not very much, at least not visibly. I think the problem that we face is to be able to attract first-class graduate students. And I think the fact that tuition, out-of-state tuition, has risen so rapidly is beginning to be a problem for us. It's impossible to assess how much of a problem it is. This year, we have not been able to add as many good students as we wanted. Now, is this really due to the out-of-state tuition going up, or is it due to something else? It's not possible to say.
I recall you did mention that most of your students seem to be Wisconsin students.
Well, they are. This has been true. Now, right now, we have three out-of-state students out of about 10. But I think in the future, well, for a long time, we had only one out-of-state student, and that was Sandy Klein. I think one time we had one out-of-state and seven or eight in-state. But now we've got, I think, 3 out of 10 are out of state, either 3 or 4. But we've got to attract students from not only Wisconsin, but other places. And I hope that the legislature doesn't make it impossible for us to do that. I don't think they will. Because we can survive for a little while without good students, but only for a little while. Our program over the years, the solar energy program has probably brought in something like $1.5 million into the university.
That's a pretty good sum.
The Rockefeller programs total probably $800,000. And the NSF and IRDA programs are total roughly another $500,000 for the, this carries us through next January. And we've had other sources of support, outside funds from industry or NSF or government agencies other than the two main ones. When you put them all together, it's a good healthy $1.5 million. And our next proposal would be for somewhere is between $1/3 and $500,000. So I think the money the state invests in this program does a number of things for it. It the money comes back, and I don't know how much the state's contribution is relative to outside, but my guess is that the bulk of the support has come from outside. So we have parlayed a state investment into a very substantial outside investment. We've been able to educate our students in a way that makes them very much in demand. We've put Wisconsin on the map in the solar energy field, which we think is an advantage to our students in both the laboratory and in our courses. On the basis of this money that comes in from outside, or on the basis of the research that it supports, we have put on short courses through Extension. We've done it 4 times and have a 5th one coming up. It's been one of the major sources of education of people who have moved into the solar field. All kinds of them show up as speakers at technical meetings and so on. We've given Engineering Extension a real boost because of the what we've been able to attract from outside. I think our educational efforts here have been very closely interrelated with our research. Our students, we just finished our course in 567, and the last problem we gave our students, some of the fellows were asking, why do we do this? Well, you haven't really got this program finished yet, and I can see their point. They had to use a computer program, and there was one program on Monday, and it was revised Monday, and there was another program on Tuesday that gave slightly different results, and some of them were kind of upset about that. And said, look, we told the students that there's only a half a dozen people in the country other than you who can do this problem. In other words, what we give our students in our course is we give them the basic stuff, but we also give them stuff that's right out of the laboratory, that literally is hours old. Our course, the last part of it, is based on our current research and the methods and techniques that our students have.
So they're learning the very latest that
getting,
you know.
They're getting the very latest stuff. And a lot of them, this doesn't mean much to, but any of them that are going into this or related fields, I think this is, it seems to me that this is what a university like this is all about. We've got research. If we separate research from our teaching, then our students, we're not doing right by the university. But we've got our students in the laboratory who are learning by doing. They're our colleagues as well as our students. We publish together. We work together on a lot of different things. We have a few undergraduates who do special projects, and even we've had 2 of them, and both of them have come up with papers. In fact, we've been somewhat chagrined to find out that IRDA has written a contract or a set of contracts for about $130,000 to do a job that is basically not much different than one of our seniors did as a 3-credit special project. And we think we think that our senior did a better job than the IRTA's getting for their big pot full of money. And we're really proud of our students. Then we got lots of public service activities that go with this too. There's Bill and to a lesser extent John Mitchell and myself are always out lecturing to Kiwanis or environmental groups or engineering societies or federal agencies or universities. We get mail and telephone calls from people around the state and other places that want to know how to do things, and we've had to put together some responses for these. We try and answer them all, not always successfully, but in other words, woven in with our research and our education is a very strong public service aspect to the whole thing.
Wisconsin's pretty proud of its record in this area, isn't it?
Sure, and we think this is great, and it's a tradition we like to carry on. It keeps us in touch with a lot of people that help to shape our program to some degree, because we don't want to, we are engineers, and engineering implies applications, and we don't want to get too isolated from the people that ultimately are going to have to use the sorts of information that we can develop.